Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking and wheeling in the UK and beyond. I'm Laura Laker, and I am currently sat on a clifftop just above Sennan Cove near Land's End in Cornwall. I've pulled over at the side of the road on my e-bike, and I am riding the National Cycle Network from Cornwall, Land's End to roughly the Taunton area, where we're going to do the opening of the street that's being opened in my dad's name. This is a special episode that we have recorded. I was with Andy Cox on Monday in Isle of Wight, and I rode with him for 30 miles on the first day of his national tour of the UK, running and cycling 30 miles a day, raising money for Road Peace. And we cycled with his brother, and I interviewed him partway along. So this is what you're about to hear. Before we get onto that, I've just looked down at my leg. I just stopped for some breakfast, a roll and some cheese on a rock on this beautiful piece of coastal path, like a gravel section between Land's End and Sennan Cove, on a lovely little pile of granite rocks. I tried to clamber down to get something off my apple and basically fell in between some rocks into some nettles. So most of my left thigh is now covered in welts that are rising up, and all my fingers are tingling. So yeah, it's been a bit of an adventure so far, and it's just the first day, so who knows what's going to happen. Yeah, so that's what I've been up to. I'm going to meet someone from Sustrans later. But in the meantime, let's hear from Andy Cox, and we can hear about his fundraising efforts and why he's doing it. So we are at the seaside on the first day of your national challenge. Do you want to quickly run us through what you're doing and what we're doing today?
Yeah, well, firstly, Laura, thank you ever so much for taking part. It's amazing to get the challenge underway. I think we've done about 10 miles, and obviously it's 30 per day. But the reason we're doing it ultimately is, number one, to raise awareness of road danger and save life in doing so, because still, unfortunately, you know, 5 people every day or thereabouts on average in the UK die, and about 24,000 people a year are permanently disabled. So that's a point that's often lost. So it's number one, to raise awareness of road danger, and number two, to raise money for Road Peace, who are a charity that support bereaved families and do so much good for them. So like any charity, they've struggled probably, and I think Road Peace is somebody we should get behind. So I'm hoping up and down the country people are raising money for Road Peace. It helps them, but obviously to raise awareness as well.
Today the theme's on the language that we use around road collisions.
To be fair, we've worked collectively, I think, on this. So many people use the word accident, and that would imply it was just one of those things. It was just something that was going to happen. It couldn't be avoided. And obviously that's not the case. This is about drivers who are making choices to drive recklessly or dangerously, and ultimate selfishness from them. So rather than using the word accident, we'd encourage the word crash or collision. And I think that sets the tone. Obviously, number one, it's offensive to bereaved families who see the word accident and see the way that it's just assumed to be one of those things when it really isn't. But number two, really, the reason this is important is to change the narrative, to make society think differently, so that we don't accept 5 people dying every day, and that we recognise that's a choice and it's driver choice and they don't have to do that and we can save life by doing that.
Because I think some people think, well, accident, does it really matter? I mean, if we're sort of catching people and we're prosecuting people, then how important is this really?
Well, I think it's really important because, you know, rather than catch, I'd rather prevent. And I think it goes to the heart of the way that we drive as a society in the country. And I think when you change your language, you change your thought process. And I think people need to recognise we can't continue to accept that many people dying, and we can't continue to accept that many people being permanently disabled. It devastates lives, both of those that are uninjured but are at fault, and obviously those that are bereaved and so on. Once we change the narrative, we change our behaviours, and this is about trying to influence a change in driving standards for improvement and to reduce danger on our road.
Yeah, and part of that is proactive policing, this data-led policing that you've been very hot on, and the recent news from the Times that the way that we sign kind of contributory factors has changed because of the way that you process the data around collisions, which was kind of astonishing actually.
So data is really essential to everything we do, because I want to know what the causes are for the collisions, when they're occurring and who's involved and everything else, so why, when, where sort of stuff, so that we can then target our police and enforcement but also encourage other agencies to be involved in the solution. So first we have to get our data right so we can be intelligence led around how we then go and tackle that and utilising innovation and other bits to resolve it. But also the astonishing nature, as you rightly say, around the change in contributory factors is something that I've said for a long time is the likely reality. So we did a study in London and in Manchester which showed if you review, and this is obvious to be fair, it's professional judgment would tell you to do this anyway, but if you review the causes of fatal collisions, the contributory factors at the end rather than the start point, you'll get a truer picture of what's happened, because clearly at the start officers might have just turned up and it'd be a very early assessment of what's happened. Yeah. And at the end we've used our specialists, it's been protracted, painstaking, complex, thorough investigation, and at the end you're going to really understand what's happened. And what that has shown us is that speeding is by far the most prevalent contributory factor. So our prediction, if London and Manchester is replicated around the country, because we've only done it there, which I think it will be, then speeding will account for about 3 to 4 times more fatality than originally thought. So actually that changes from around about 250 to up to about 750 towards 1,000 fatalities every year linked to speeding. So I think that then allows us to push, for example, things like speed limiting technology and legislation around that to encourage manufacturers to do that as well, but also to make people stop and think themselves around how they drive, wherever they choose to speed. Because I think speed ultimately comes back to a complacency by the driver who thinks it won't happen to them.
Yeah.
Well, I can now say, well, 750 to 1,000 people unfortunately lose their life every year because somebody chose to speed. So,
that's out of about 1,600 fatalities a year that we're getting, so that's more than half. It's quite astonishing, really. Yeah. It's kind of a big change, but it's almost, you think, well, why didn't we do this before? You know it's a big problem. Other people must have noticed it's a big problem. If it was a case that something was being recorded initially, like you said, but then it wasn't getting updated when more facts were known, when the investigation had completed, and it just seems kind of obvious, actually. I wonder, you've kind of said what you'd like to happen now. There's a kind of an issue with speeding that I find quite interesting around, like, the resistance against speed cameras, a resistance against tackling speed, and you get this kind of narrative around, oh, it's not real crime, catch some real criminals, or you kind of see these comments from some people. And I wonder if you think this is going to change the narrative, or if it's more the case that we need to be changing the narrative around this and just saying, actually, this is a huge problem, we need to do something about it, and just kind of, yeah, I guess ignore the voices that are saying this is nonsense.
I think so, because one of the most offensive comments to the roast policing teams are, go and catch a real criminal. When I can point to so many occurrences where our team stops somebody breaking a traffic law, and what I would define as a road crime, because language is important again, it's a road crime, are committing other crime as well. So the two often go hand in hand. Not always, but you know, on occasion do. And some really high profile cases where we've arrested the most wanted offenders for other crime, murder, etc., who are stopped for a traffic offence through speeding or not wearing a seatbelt. So it's offensive for two reasons, but it's most offensive because not only are they a criminal and breaking the law, but they are risking life. And we know that more lives are lost because of a speeding driver than murder and terrorism combined every year. So we absolutely have to explain that to people to make them realise that. But we also have to keep pushing on, really, because there will be people, unfortunately, who won't accept it, will think it's okay for them. They will want the really fast car, and I have to think about why, as a society, we are so accepting of really fast, powerful cars when actually the limit is 70 miles an hour. The most you can drive in the UK is at 70. Yeah, cars have been rolled off their manufacturing production line at, you know, capable of doing way over 150, so way over double the speed limit. So why is that? Why haven't we introduced technology? I think these are all things that we need to genuinely debate and think about, because, you know, it's easy if you've been unaffected by road crime to think, what is, you know, what we worried about. But actually, if you've lost a loved one, or you're permanently disabled, or you've been impacted in any way, as so many are, then that's the rationale and the impact it has. So let's think differently as a society, I think.
Yeah, and you were talking earlier about how you've conducted murder investigations, and you've had sort of 50, 60 people on those, and whereas with road collision investigation, it's a lot smaller. And I also noted recently, looking back to the policing cuts that we had between 2009 and 2019, that roads policing was disproportionately cut. We've got an excited dog in the background.
It's a puppy.
It looks like a guide dog puppy in training. It's got a little... No?
Ability dog.
It's a very cute puppy. Yeah, I wonder, because I was curious about why roads policing in the first place. This dog lost so many officers compared with sort of policing. Was that sort of nationally led, or was that local police thinking, actually, this isn't a priority? Or
so I think there's lots of resources that work in policing that will also work in other forms of policing. So local policing, for example, might be dedicated to the community sort of work or tackling other crime, but we'll still have on occasion a role to play around stopping a vehicle and enforcing road crime. So the numbers of resources working on it sometimes are hard to work out exactly if we've gone up, we've gone down, or whatever. But I still think collectively across every agency, including policing, more priority needs to be given to road death and tackling that. Because I think if you look at the news, for example, how many times, rightly so by the way, have we heard about knife crime, violence against women and girls, all absolute priorities and horrific when they happen, and, you know, youth murder and so on. But how many times do we hear about a fatal road crash? It's often low down the priority list in terms of the media, low down the priority list in terms of the agencies involved. And I think, you know, we need to change that. So there's definitely something we can do around resourcing. I look at legislative change as well. So I think if you look at the sentencing of, there's this thing, as you know, called exceptional hardship.
Yeah.
Which I find astonishing. So somebody who's got accrued 12 points, pleads to the judge that the impact of losing their licence will be severe on them in terms of their family, their personal circumstances, their employment. But everybody knows if you get to 12 points, you should lose your licence. So, and so often people keep their licence by pleading hardship. And I say, well, the hardship's with the bereaved family. And this person had a chance to address their behaviour. So I think, you know, really we should look at every aspect, so not just policing, not just, you know, legislation, sentencing, societal thinking. It's a whole big picture of issues, really, that play out. But that's why we're here, right? So we are now trying to raise awareness of that. And I'm really pleased as well that this isn't just me. There's a lot of police officers up and down the country are taking part. There's a lot of communications going out. Got a fantastic support team helping us as well. So hopefully it has a demonstration of policing is committed to tackling road danger. We're asking for help, really.
Not all police committed to tackling road danger, not all police around cyclists particularly, and vulnerable road users. You still get the kind of I'll give them a high-vis vest and tell them to follow the highway code kind of attitudes. One of the things that you talk about is the importance of investing in camera technology, but some of them similarly don't, because they perhaps don't recognize the benefit. How do you kind of change the minds of the police who don't get it?
So there was a recent example, I won't mention the police force, but a police force tweeted out essentially in Cycling Week, it was, they were saying, you know, go out in your helmet, your yellow vest, etc., etc. And were really very clear on that. And I privately messaged them in the background and said, actually, you know, for example, if it was an assault on a female, we wouldn't say, well, the female shouldn't have worn, you know, that. So trying to draw a comparison between victim blaming and actually trying to draw people's attention to the cyclist when, you know, they unfortunately are involved in these serious crashes. It will be the driver who isn't looking, who's driving, you know, badly. It's reckless, selfish and poor driving behaviour. So very much avoid victim blame, focus on the cause, deal with the cause, not the victim. And they took their message down, put out a completely different message, and I think that's how we can start to influence. So I do that in the background, but it does frustrate me, clearly. And I've intentionally today not worn a high vis for that very reason, and I wasn't going to anyway, but to make the point, really, that this is about changing driving culture. But it's a challenging subject, and I think it will take a lot of learning, not just within policing, but elsewhere, to address that as well.
Yeah. You talked about how you can't have an active travel policy without a roads policing policy. Can you just sort of speak a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm an absolutely huge fan of active travel. I think, obviously, benefits to the environment, benefits to, you only have to look at cost of living at the moment, cost of fuel, benefits to finance, benefits to health, benefits to mental health, all impacts on policing, but wider society as well. So I think by having good active travel, what's not to really like about that? And I think policing obviously needs to be really part of a support structure that helps that develop. Because I think, you know, to have active travel, you need to have confidence that you're going to be safe walking or cycling. And therefore, you need to limit danger, you need to change the culture of driving, you need to enforce what you need to enforce. So I think to have really strong active travel support, you need to have an anti-road danger piece, you need to tackle road danger to create an environment that supports active travel. So I think active travel's here for the future. It's obviously the way we all need to go. There's a huge movement in that direction, rightly so. So what I'd like to do is make sure our danger reduction strategies are lined up, not just policing, but policing needs to play a part to understand that and support that.
And if you had carte blanche to do whatever you wanted around this road danger, because this is your passion, right? I mean, you obviously think it's really important, in all seriousness. If you could sort of do anything, if you could like have a role where you could do anything, you could sort of have the resource you needed, prioritise what you wanted to have the effect that you wanted to cut road danger, what would you do?
So I think I'd be an intelligence-led, evidence-based lead. So if I think back to work in London, there's over 9,000 roads in London. We, through analysis of fatal crash locations, analysis of the causes, analysis of the type of driver, everything involved, worked out when, where, why, and cut 9,000 roads down to 136.
Yeah, those are the most dangerous roads.
The most dangerous roads, yes. And then further refined that 136 down to about 4. So didn't mean we never went to the 9,000 roads, but it meant we prioritised the 136 and we really prioritised the 4. And I think you could do that around the country. I also think you could target the most dangerous drivers. Again, thinking back to London work, we identified the most dangerous drivers, about 500, and essentially day and night targeted those drivers. And surprise, surprise, we found weapons, guns, drugs, counterfeit currency, stolen vehicles, disqualified drivers, wanted people. And they didn't drive for very long, so because we really targeted them. And I think you could, for example, make that 5,000-10,000 drivers across the country. I think, you know, communication strategies are really important. So you'd have a really strong strategy, you'd have really strong governance, you'd have national policy around the right road, when, where, why, you'd have the right driver, you'd have a really empowered policy around the public, because I think around reporting road crimes, you alluded to earlier around headcam, dashcam. Now, I've empowered essentially 66 million people in the country to be part of the solution and encourage policing to receive that, deal with that, enforce that. Yeah. And therefore, everybody's part of the solution. And work really collaboratively with every agency you can think of, you know, statutory, voluntary, commercial, to address the issues, including judiciary and CPS and sentencing. So there's a long way of saying it. I think there is a role really where, and this has been really well led by Chief Constable Joe Shiner, obviously from Sussex, who's the Roads Policing lead, who understands that and is delivering that. And I think it's just getting more people to buy into the right strategies and the right focus and the right support, both within and further afield from policing.
Because Joe Shiner is also the Chief Constable for Sussex Police, which you were saying is a big job already. Do other crimes have sort of national leads? I mean, is there a national murder investigation lead? Is there?
There is. Yeah. So we tend to do our what you'd argue is our day job. So for example, my day job's head of crime in Lincolnshire, but I'd pick up work around collision investigation as a portfolio. And so we would have leads for everything you can imagine on top of their day job.
Okay, they all have day jobs as well. Okay.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah. So
do you think that's a good thing? It seems like it's quite a lot to take on. You've already got a full-time job and you're like, what, doing this evenings and weekends?
It is a challenge, definitely. But for me, the main thing around road danger is, you know, the passion. And genuinely, I think there's not a huge amount of people that are nationally really taking this agenda to a different level. And I think it's a huge open goal of an opportunity to take this over the next 5-10 years. Because ultimately, the goal is Vision Zero. And I think with autonomous vehicles and things coming down the line, that is achievable. But you have to have people now who are really passionate in driving that. And I think, you know, the next 5-10 years we will see significant improvement in the fatality rate, but it is lots of different leaders in lots of different sectors being more collaborative, because we tend to work in isolation in my view, and I think that's something we can change as well.
Tell us about your challenge.
So we've got a lot of forces up and down the country taking part. I'm doing 30 miles a day, started obviously today, finishing in Staffordshire at the Arboretum on Sunday. I've got Jeremy Vine coming out with me on Wednesday, Sarah Story coming out on Saturday. My brother's here today.
Yeah, say hi.
Hi there. Hi.
Do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
I'm Andy's older brother, Dave, and I've sorted out the route for him today, so hopefully we'll finish it.
Dave's been leading us around the Isle of Wight, so the Coxes are from the Isle of Wight, so is this why we're starting here? Is there a kind of road safety angle? Is this just like where you started?
Yeah, this is where I live when I grew up, so down here for family, but there is actually a place in East Cowes which shows the first ever fatal crash, I think, on the Isle of Wight. So we might have to...
I know where that is.
Yeah.
It's that near Apps Heath?
Yeah.
It's a road near Apps Heath.
We'll have to look at it on the way back, I think.
Yeah.
But you know, we've got an amazing setting right now, so whilst I'm doing this challenge and it's like really important, it's actually great fun as well, right?
Yeah.
So we're sitting near a beach and we're looking at the sea. It's actually got sunny and
it's a stunning view. We've got this enormous kind of seascape around us and we're sitting on in a cafe. It's not a bad way to raise awareness of road danger.
There's worse ways to do it. We've raised already for the road piece, and I know I mentioned earlier why it's important. You obviously support Brief families, and the idea of raising money for them, and they haven't got a lot of money, in fairness, so this is not a well-funded charity, is they do put support sessions on for families who 20 years later say, I still have to go to that support session. And obviously the more money they have, the more sessions they can do, they can cover a larger geographical area. And I've had a contact from actually outside the UK asking, can road piece extend to there? So it's starting to get real momentum. But we've raised, as we sit here now, around about 57,000, but the target's 100,000, so anybody listening, and I know this may go out after the challenge, but the Just Giving link is at the top of my Twitter feed, and anybody who's got the opportunity and spare cash who's willing today is hugely appreciated.
They make a really big difference, don't they? Because it's not just people, like families have bereaved. It's a very sort of violent way to lose someone, isn't it? One minute they're there and then the next they're, you can't, I mean, unless you've been through it, it's impossible to imagine really. And yeah, and these are kind of ripples that carry on throughout someone's life, aren't they? So yeah.
And they also champion and hold police into account, and they hold other agencies to account. They champion change. So they are really a force for good, and they're amazing, amazing people. The people that work there who are supporting this challenge, so this is very much multiple people involved, you know, really, really are fantastic people who do need that support so that they can support others.
Yeah, and then obviously the people who've had sort of lifelong injuries as well, and I think we don't really talk about them a lot. And I mean, it's something that's of interest to me. My dad had quite a bad collision when he was 16 and he was cycling and almost lost his leg. And he had one leg shorter than the other for the rest of his life. And I think psychologically it did kind of stay with him for the rest of his life. And, you know, he wouldn't have come through any statistics, or he didn't seek any help for things. But I think it's a lot bigger problem than we perhaps realise.
It's interesting because our dad had the same when he was about 17.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so his shin... Yeah, it's full of metal basically today, and our dad joined us at the start of the challenge today, but thankfully quickly exited the stage, so we didn't have to pull up with him the whole journey. But that's certainly not the reason that I'm motivated, but I do see the impact for everybody, and having sort of worked in fatal crash investigation and met, to be honest with you, hundreds of families that have lost loved ones, but also lots of people that have been disabled and so on. It's a lifelong impact.
So like in your early career, you kind of move around until you find your specialism. What kind of drew you to road collisions?
Well, this is quite a funny story. So I started policing in 99, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm gonna have to say it now. Have never issued a traffic ticket in my life, so I know.
I mean, I think you hadn't really gotten a bike for, what did you say, 20
no,
years?
No, it's 20, it's literally 20 years to the day.
Yesterday you might have gone on a ride with this bike that you borrowed.
I had a little practice yesterday, I've got an amazing bike, by the way, for it, which is helping immensely. So I was very much to be a detective to run murder, and my chief constable in 2012 promoted me to superintendent, and I thought I was going into a crime and intelligence role. And she goes, I'm going to move you to a role called specialist operations, Andy. I said, right, that involves guns and road policing. I said, I've never issued a traffic ticket, I've never had a gun, so why on earth would I want to work there, sort of like that. And it was a bit of a non-negotiable conversation anyway, so I had to go there. But he said, you're going to really enjoy it, you're going to change it, and you'll make a difference. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me, and that was in Northamptonshire. And that role opened me up to the whole problem-solving nature of this, the whole preventative nature of it. Perhaps pre-2012, I had the attitude of, well, it was over there, and it's maybe just one of those things. Exactly the attitude we need to change.
But in terms of collisions happening, yeah. It just happens.
I suppose I had an attitude. I didn't really understand it, and therefore, when I went into the role in 2012, I realised and became very intelligence-led, data-led. So brought a crime mind, I think, to a role where not many sort of senior detectives had worked in it before, and felt, well, you absolutely can prevent this. It isn't inevitable. You just need to use your data and then really ruthlessly go after every aspect. And definitely did that in Northamptonshire, and it made an impact. And then I got back into the work, obviously, in London later.
So it kind of happened by accident, but then you kind of realised the impact it could have. And I guess maybe seeing the results of road collisions firsthand and how sort of devastating that can be.
Definitely. I think it was a fresh pair of eyes with a completely different mindset to was able to essentially transform the type of strategies we were using, and, you know, very much see it as a crime, see it as a prevention opportunity, see the impact. All the same strategies I was using for murder investigation were being used in collision investigation, of course. So there was no difference in the type of investigation, but unfortunately, yeah, the resource levels are different. But I think, yeah, that goes back to mindset. But the main thing for me was it was a role which I recognised was about saving life, tackling crime, and the public absolutely wanted us to do it. So it was like ticking all of my boxes for professional satisfaction, enjoyment, and obviously emotional aspects as well.
So Active Travel England is obviously getting off the ground now. There's a load of new schemes that are going to be happening. But also, like you said, if you're going to have like an Active Travel policy, then you need to have a policing policy. How much do you think you'll be working with Active Travel England, and what sort of role can they play in improving road safety?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think Active Travel England is the future. So I see it as, you know, support, obviously, for pedestrians and cycling. We have to provide, we have to create an environment where the benefits of active travel, which are health, substantially mental health, environmental, economy, environment, is very, very different, isn't it, from having congestion on a road to having cycle lanes and people getting about and looking after themselves. And there's an obvious link through effective active travel to reduction in road danger. So why I'm such a strong supporter professionally is because people will sometimes say to me, why don't you enforce cycling offences? And I will say, we do, but proportionately, because the risk of a cyclist hurting somebody is so very different to a vehicle hurting somebody. So, you know, the stats would be sort of 99.7% of fatalities linked to a vehicle rather than a cyclist. So there's a road danger reduction benefit, there's congestion benefit, and all the other benefits I mentioned. So what police has to do to be part of, and other agencies in fairness, is to create an environment which supports active travel. And I think clearly running alongside that is danger reduction. Cyclists and pedestrians will need to feel confident to go about their travel. Therefore, we need to enforce if bad driving, enforce and remove danger from the road, and create a supportive environment where people have the confidence that they will be safe on their journey. So that's, I see, a critical role where we can dovetail our strategies to support back to travelling.
Yeah, because I guess even if you've got bike lanes everywhere, you're still going to have sort of like low traffic neighbourhoods, you're still going to encounter some drivers, and they're going to need to know sort of, and a lot of it's education, I guess. It's not all sort of ticketing people.
And I think the use of, for example, headcam here, so the benefit of headcam is not really about the people we enforce against, and we do, and people lose their licence because of people reporting footage to police. But I really see the benefit is in deterrence, because when everybody realises that it's not just the police, it's not just the speed camera that can enforce, it's the driver next to you, who is one of them essentially, then they will be more inclined to drive sensibly. So I think deterrence has a big part. So therefore, I really would welcome cyclists using headcams and reporting offences, because in light of the new highway code, in light of active travel, with the technology that's available, we can really tackle drivers who don't respect cycling, who think they've got that entitlement to get past the cyclist regardless of risk. So by tackling that and showing that they don't have that entitlement, actually we're going to take the license from them when they do, then I think again that goes to the heart of encouraging safe cycling, supporting active travel and reducing danger on the road.
So that was me and Andy Cox. I hope you enjoyed the chat, also by the sea in the Isle of Wight, which is absolutely beautiful. He is doing some great stuff for raising awareness of road safety, and also huge physical effort on his part for the second year running, and just hats off to him. So we'll put a link in the show notes to his fundraising campaign, just in case you have any spare cash to send his way. As he was saying, Roadpeace does some hugely important work around supporting the bereaved families of road danger victims and making real change in the way that police tackle road danger and use kind of evidence to make the road safer. So yeah, all power to him. And by the time this goes out, I don't know where he'll be, possibly in the Sheffield area, the Peak District of Dame Sarah Story, who apparently is taking him on a very hilly route. So if he gets some extra cash, I'm sure he'll appreciate it. Anyway, I'm on a cliff top, probably should get going. I need to meet someone soon, and I keep getting distracted by the view. It's just stunning. I mean, I'm sitting here, there's a bay in front of me, a big wide bay with this blue, just this sort of aquamarine sea, this turquoise sea. I won't stand up because it's quite windy actually, and these just great big white waves crashing against rocks, and yeah, it's just ridiculously beautiful. I keep stopping to look at it, and I probably should get going. So anyway, you've been listening to our special edition of Streets Ahead. I think Ned's in Italy somewhere on the Giro, Adam's in the West Midlands, and we couldn't bring ourselves together to do a recording remotely in three different locations with me on the road and Ned on the road. I hope you enjoyed it, and you can find us on Twitter at @PodStreetsAhead. Rate us and review us, it does help. Share it with anyone you think might enjoy it, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.